This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Reverend Jesse Jackson and Dr. Cornell West exchange notes on the election and the Black Lives Matter movement. A noted whistleblower says that Flint, Michigan was poisoned deliberately, and an extended interview with Umi Saleh of the Dream Defenders. But first, the city of Greenville, South Carolina, has witnessed two large funerals in recent days, one for a white cop, the other for a young black man who the police claim killed the officer and then committed suicide. Black young people in Greenville don't buy the police version of Deontay Perry Mackey's death, and neither does Afia Wangaza, director of Greenville's Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination.
It's mysterious as to how what happened to Deontay, who was a promising young man and by all accounts a leader in the community among young people, that he was accused of shooting a cop whose name is Alan Jacobs, who has a reputation for endearing himself to the elders and harassing and bullying the youth, especially the males. And then after having shot and killed Alan Jacobs, Deontay is supposed to have shot himself with a gun that Jacobs was supposed to be asking him about. We are beginning to piece together the facts of the situation, and it appears at this point that this kid has been targeted and was targeted by Jacobs. He was arrested about a year ago by Jacobs on an allegation of strong-arm robbery, which turned out to be where Deontay was on the street having been kicked out of school with a friend, and someone approached him, an adult approached him about buying a dime bag of reefer. And once having gotten the $10, Deontay is supposed to have refused to get the reefer or to give him the $10 back, and said, according to the informant's affidavit, that he threatened to shoot him if he persisted in demanding the $10. Well, that's questionable in and of itself in the first place. I mean, since when did people buying reefer and getting purportedly ripped off go and file a complaint with the police department in order to get their money back? So that's suspicious. Secondly, it is our feeling that the police are putting, as well as drugs, guns on the streets and in the hands of youth. And in this particular case, that they had an informant to give Deontay a gun. Once the transfer had been made, then they were notified of the transfer or where the transfer, if the informant was wired, and the two cops, Alan Jacobs and his partner, who is black, Jacobs being white, approached Deontay to question him reportedly about a warrant, an outstanding warrant, which Jacobs did not even have, and we still haven't been able to determine what the warrant was supposed to be for, and it's never appeared. At any rate, Jacobs approaches Deontay, threatens to arrest him on this non-existent, non-appearing warrant, and Deontay is supposed to have shot and killed Jacobs, called his mother, Deontay calling his own mother, saying, I just killed a cop, I'm not going back to jail, and so I'm going to kill myself, and is supposed to have committed suicide. Now, there's SWAT teams all around at that time. So there's a question about who actually killed Jacobs and who killed Deontay Mackey, because the Greenville law enforcement has a history of friendly fire and sacrificing young black males to cover for those crimes. There are a number of young black males who are serving life sentences as a result of these kinds of encounters. So the feeling is that this is another situation where the cop died as a result of friendly fire. Deontay is the sacrificial lamb, and rather than having him left around to tell the tale, they just killed him. So the misleadership of Greenville, on one hand, is trying to keep a lid on everything. They did create a wonderful homegoing for Deontay that allowed young people to express their condolences and their support of him and to generate and display the dignity and worth, that appreciation that he enjoyed in the community. At the same time, you know, the white folks, of course, they've been raising hundreds of thousands of dollars. They had cops from all over the country to come in for the funeral, and it's just been a big thing going on and a lot of tension because young people are of the position that it's not even Stephen. It's not a 50-50 situation. It's that this cop was a dirty cop. He harassed the community, that they are tired of the occupation of the community. They are committed to, at this point, developing their own patrols and calling for black community control of the police and launching their own people's investigation of what actually happened.
So this sounds like an organizing moment for Greenville.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm just coming out of a meeting right now with some young activists so that we can begin to mobilize and figure out what our strategy is going to be in order to take advantage of this moment.
When cops get killed, the other cops usually go on the warpath. How are they behaving in Greenville's black community?
Exactly the same way. They are flying through the community at high speeds. They have been consistently stopping people, generally with the general harassment being ratcheted up another 20 to 25%. So there was a town hall meeting where young people pointed out that they are all treated as criminals, quote-unquote criminals and thugs, that they want the cops out of the community, to come in only when they're called. The Nation of Islam stepped up and has offered to do security training. There are young people who are prepared to take them up on that. So it is an organizing moment, and the cops are well aware. Although they had been invited to come to the town hall meeting over the objections of members of the community, the cops recognized the importance of not appearing, and they did not come. So the lines are drawn. The lines are drawn here, and it's a question of not only being able to take advantage of the moment, but being able to do it in a way that's going to meet the needs of the community, including developing indigenous leadership and advocacy.
And what role is the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination playing in this?
We are ground zero, organizing, educating, and we've already began classes using the Uhuru Movement, People's Grand Jury for Mike Brown as an example, as a model for our next steps.
Afio Wangaza, speaking from Greenville, South Carolina. Reverend Jesse Jackson, the Chicago-based minister who ran for president as a Democrat in 1984 and 1988, came to Columbia University in New York for a conversation on the current election with Dr. Cornel West, who's supporting Bernie Sanders for president. Reverend Jackson was asked if he's endorsed anyone in the Democratic primaries.
No, I chose so far to direct the what, not just who. Because between Hillary and Bernie, that is an interest for a game, and then that is a Cruz-Trump game. And I'm playing for the Super Bowl November 8th. And I hope that they will vow to support each other and blend those agendas and not go the way of this right-wing curve. Because we share the passion of Bernie, for example. He speaks of when you unleash the banks on people with the Glass-Steagall Act, the banks got freed up, the children got locked up, through the long winter, jobs went out, and poor people got cut up. That's a fight worth fighting. That's a fight worth fighting. On the other hand, and his strength is fighting that fight of the concentration of capital and not democratizing capital. He calls it socialism, which I think is a burdensome term in this climate. But democratizing capitalism is the same thing, and we need to democratize capital. Two few got too much, two men don't have enough, and that's the economic fight about that. Having said that, Hillary is beating he and Trump, in part because of also a history of struggle from working for the poor people in the Delta, Mississippi, and Arkansas, the Children of the French Farm, the Voting Rights Act, so she has. And so they have far more in common than they have in conflict. And I look forward to our coming out of this convention with a sense of a bigger tent, with more people involved in that tent.
Reverend Jesse Jackson. Dr. Cornell West, the Saunders supporter, is based at Union Theological Seminary, just across the street from Columbia University. Dr. West said he understands that Reverend Jackson might want to stand above the fray.
But I think we also have to be very honest about Sister Hillary, that she is, what can you say? Well, put it this way, when you hear the word integrity, her name is not the first one that comes to mind. And what I love about the tradition that I come out of, produce this brother as well, is issues of integrity, genuine conviction, moral consistency, whatever the cost and consequences, that's the kind of statesperson, male or female, black or white, red or yellow, you really want to fight for. And at this particular moment, that fight is still going on. At this moment in New York City, is still going on. Now, granted, Hillary Clinton is better than the neo-fascist in the making called Donald Trump. There's no doubt about that. I mean, a neoliberal versus a neo-fascist, there is a difference. But neoliberals are still dangerous.
Dr. Cornell West, speaking at Columbia University in New York. Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, the Black Agenda Report editor and columnist, attended three of the recent congressional hearings on the poisoning of the water system in Flint, Michigan. Adebayo used to work for the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. She successfully sued the agency and was the key actor in passage of legislation to protect whistleblowers from government retaliation. Adebayo said the poisoning of Flint was a deliberate act.
The internal culture of EPA is really one of intimidation, of fear-mongering, of everyone inside the agency understanding the terms of engagement. And those terms of engagement are very simple, but they're profound. The unwritten terms of engagement basically focus on the fact that the EPA is a quasi-military organization, and I would argue that most federal agencies are quasi-military. We have a very quasi-military structure with branch chiefs and directors, and we use military terms in terms of AWOL and all that sort of thing, standing down and all that, so that when you go into the agency, you begin to realize that there's a certain discipline within the agency, and that if you breach that discipline, there are consequences for breaching the discipline. And so I think what we see in the Flint story, as we've seen in other stories, is this quasi-military organization that has very specific rules of engagement, particularly as it relates to its employees and to its contractors. And once you breach those rules, at that point, the agency becomes a major arm of retaliation against you and against the people in the agency. So we see that in the Flint situation, as we've seen it in other situations, with Miguel de Tora, who was the EPA employee who was doing his job. Leanne Waters, who is the mother in Flint, Michigan, who was determined to figure out why her son has developed rashes all over his body, why his behavior has suddenly changed, why this little boy that used to do so well in school is now failing. And so she reaches out to state and local governments. They fail her. They just have no interest in pursuing her complaints. And so finally she reaches out to the EPA, and specifically she reached out to Miguel de Tora, and she asked him to come to Flint, Michigan to test the water and to determine if there was something wrong going on in the water supply. So Miguel de Tora does everything right. He goes to Flint, Michigan. He's from Region 5, so he's stationed in Chicago. So he goes to Flint, Michigan, tests her water, and then he writes a very important document to his supervisors, which essentially state that the lead in her water exceeds the acceptable limits for lead in the water, according to EPA standards. And he goes on to say that he needs to go back to Flint and he needs to pursue further testing. At that point, and this is the reason why we know that the poisoning was deliberate, one of the reasons, there are a lot of reasons we know that the poisoning was deliberate. Now, he has three supervisors over him, and so this memo is being sent through various stages of the system, and in each stage of the system, he is getting the order to stand down. But we know at some point, like maybe within 3 or 4 weeks, that the EPA administrator, Susan Hetman, who's the former EPA administrator, receives this memo. And I think at that point, the final order is given for Miguel de Tora to stand down. And at that point, really, the research and the testing stops at that point, at least at Ms. Warder's house. And so she's still left with questions about the health risks her children are facing. And at that point, Ms. Warders and other people in the community began to organize around this brown water, around this horrific smell that's coming out of their pipes. And finally, a doctor, Dr. Hannah, who was able to compare medical documents of these same children who are now coming to her office, and she notices that something has gone terribly wrong. And as she says in so many reports, you know, when you suspect it's lead, that is a major disaster, and all the bells and whistles need to go off. So that episode at EPA tells us a lot about the culture of EPA and why supporting whistleblowers is really the last defense that any community really has, because it could have ended there with de Tora. He could have said, look, you know, I've got kids in college, I've got a mortgage, and I just can't pursue this because I've gotten a message from the agency to stand down. But instead of doing that, he writes another memo essentially saying, look, I'm really fearing that the community in Flint is facing a major water catastrophe. Those are not his exact words, but this is a major water crisis. And that the agency is not doing its job in terms of protecting the health and welfare of this community. At that point, retaliation really sets in, because at that point, the agency knows that they've already told him to stand down. He hasn't taken the hint. And his office is moved to, like, I think he's called a little corner office. Basically, he's sort of sidelined so that, quote unquote, he can't do any more damage. Now, the latest memo that came out from de Tora came out this week, in which he actually calls EPA a cesspool. And he says that, you know, this EPA is essentially a cesspool, and it doesn't really have the interests of the people and the communities at heart. That's a really important memo, because at that point he's saying, I've done everything I can do, and this agency is not helping, is not prepared to protect these people in Flint, Michigan. So you have that process going on in terms of the culture of EPA and how this is an organization that's really much more interested in supporting corporations, particularly the pesticide chemical industries, rather than the communities that rely on the agency. And then you have the congressional hearings. I attended 3 congressional hearings on Flint, and they were all fascinating. But again, this culture of EPA just permeates the hearings, because you have an EPA administrator who submits an editorial to the Washington Post in advance of her testimony to try to sort of troubleshoot a bit, in which she says EPA bears no responsibility whatsoever for what happened in Flint. And she calls Susan Hetman, who not only lied to the people of Flint, but also was, I believe, actively involved in forcing Miguel de Tora to stand down. She calls the same woman, Susan Hetman, courageous for resigning from the EPA. So we know who she thinks are the heroes in this case. She thinks the managers and Susan Heppman, who told Miguel de Toro to stand down, are the heroes. And the people who stood up for the people in Flint are the troublemakers. And I think that that's a really important message that we should get from the Gina McCarthy editorial to the Washington Post, of who she thinks are the real heroes and who she thinks are the enemies. So Congress, of course, was, I think, sort of dumbfounded, to be honest with you, because Gina McCarthy was, quite frankly, she just didn't give a damn. She just could care less. And it was clear throughout her testimony when she kept, you know, shrugging her shoulders and saying, I don't know. I don't think anybody's to blame. I think there's enough blame to go all around, but not EPA. EPA had nothing to do with the blame. But for the governor and for the Michigan Environmental Quality Agency, they should bear the blame of this whole thing. The problem with that is under the Safe Drinking Water Act, I think it's 1431, it gives the EPA administrator emergency powers. And those emergency powers state very clearly that if states and local municipalities do not act in the interest of the people, of their constituents, that as EPA administrator, she has emergency powers to step in, usurp their power, and provide protection for those communities. Now, that was the only time I think I saw her sort of, you know, look around a little bit, because she clearly knew she had emergency powers to step in, and she did nothing. So I think Congress was a bit taken aback by how boastful she was about how great EPA is in the face of Flint, how the fact that she did nothing wrong in the face of Flint, and how she just seemed very cavalier about it. And let me just say one other thing. I think one of the reasons why the administrator and Susan Heppman and the governor of Michigan seem very cavalier about this whole process is because I think they all realized that nothing was going to happen to them. And to date, not a single charge has been brought against any of these people for poisoning an entire American city, not even a misdemeanor charge. So it's the reason why they could all go to Congress, spend 3 or 4 hours testifying, be as arrogant and as vile as possible, and not have to look over their shoulders worrying that anyone was going to come and back at them with handcuffs. So for me, it was very sad because there were so many people in the audience who were suffering from poisoning, but I thought it was a clear demonstration of what it's like to work inside the federal government.
What do you mean when you say the poisoning was intentional? Do you mean the EPA intended not to intervene or something darker?
Both. And I think the both deals with the long history of Africans in this country and how many times are we going to keep saying, oops, they made a mistake. You know, after a while, I think that gets a bit tired. And it's almost the same kind of situation where people want to keep saying that it's just a couple of bad apples in the police department that are killing unarmed black men and women, and therefore you don't want to look at the structure. You just want to say, if we can just excise these couple of bad apples and the police forces will be perfectly capable of protecting the black community. And so you're not prepared to look at the structure. You're not prepared to look at the history and the real goals and mission of police forces in terms of how they operate in the black community. So you're in this constant state of saying it was a mistake or we have bad apples. It's the same situation in Flint. I mean, this is not the first time that the federal government has acted in a way that promotes the demise of black people in this country. I've written so many articles about this in Black Agenda. I mean, the Flint crisis makes the Tuskegee experiment look like child's play. It just simply does. The scale of it is so much larger, and you have to wonder what is the strategy here. We know that EPA, the state of Michigan, knew that these people, that this community was being poisoned at least over 9 months, at least over 9 months. So it's hard to keep saying that this was an accident when this crisis takes place over 9 months. I mean, if it were an accident, one would think a day, 2 days, a week, maybe 2 weeks, but 9 months. and you have all the memos going back and forth. In fact, there's one memo, again, dealing with Miguel de Toro and the Michigan Environmental Quality Council, in which the Michigan Environmental Quality Council is saying, you know, what are we supposed to do with this de Toro memo that's saying that Flint, Michigan is being horribly poisoned? I mean, they had their other research, but what are they supposed to do with this particular memo? And you have Region 5 saying, well, since we told you that the de Toro memo should not have been sent out and should not have been made public, you can simply ignore it. So in that situation, you actually see EPA advising the Michigan Environmental Quality Council on how to skirt any public knowledge of the de Toro memo. Now, I don't know how you get around saying that this is deliberate, that this is a purposeful poisoning of a community. A Virginia Tech scientist, Mark Edwards, he talks openly about a cover-up. He talks openly about a cover-up. The state officials were colluding with EPA officials and the governor's office to cover up what was going on in Flint, Michigan. So if it's a cover-up, then clearly there's deliberate action being taken here. So I think in my mind there is no question that this poisoning was deliberate. And as I said before, the fact that no one has been charged with a crime, not even a misdemeanor, means that the state has sanctioned and that they're protecting the people who participated in this deliberate poisoning of Flint, Michigan.
If the EPA is going to behave that way in Flint, Michigan, where there were all of these indications that something was horribly wrong, what about the 2,000 other water systems that a recent investigation has shown are also afflicted with lead poisoning?
Again, we have the same system. And if you look at the map, if you go to the USA Today's article, which I would recommend that everyone who's listening to this interview take time and read the article, because it was a very interesting investigation that took place. We find that there are 2,000 other communities that are facing, some are worse than Flint. For example, the Washington, D.C. poisoning was, I think Mark Edwards said, was 7 times worse than Flint. So some of the communities will be worse than Flint, and some will be not as excessive as Flint. But, you know, we've got 2,000 water systems that are all impacted by lead. But what I thought was particularly interesting is that we have about 400 daycare centers that we know of in this country where lead levels have exceeded EPA standard. So that means that we have literally tens of thousands of children in this country who are now being actively poisoned. And one can only think about what the United States would have done in a testosterone-energized foreign policy if the guys in Paris who carried out the massacre, or if ISIS had poisoned an American city. The Marines would have been called out. We would have been droning and bombing them. We've been lighting up the sky over certain countries with bombs. But here we have the EPA, the governor of Michigan, and the Michigan Environmental Quality Council. They poisoned, deliberately poisoned Flint, Michigan, and we don't even have charges brought against them. I mean, that to me, it says so much about how this is state-sponsored, state-protected. This was a state-protected activity.
And I understand that there's a petition that's been posted regarding this catastrophe.
Basically, we are demanding new leadership. We have 2,000 water systems that are pumping lead poisoning into homes. We've got 400 known daycare centers where we're poisoning our children on a daily basis. Something has to change. And something has to change rather quickly if we're going to save ourselves and save our communities. And so we've posted a petition actually on the White House petition board. Please see the link to that petition at the end of my latest Black Agenda Report article. And I would ask everyone to please participate in this process, because I don't think there's a person or a community that's really immune from government-sanctioned poisoning at this point. And so it's important for all of us to work together to end the poisoning of American cities and our children.
Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo, speaking from Maryland.
Umi Saleh, the leader of the Florida-based Dream Defenders, who was formerly known as Philip Agnew, spoke recently with Pascal Robert, a frequent contributor to Black Agenda Report. Saleh talked about movement politics and the limitations and dangers of over-dependence on social media.
What we felt over a year and a half ago was that not just the movement at large, but as far as our reflection, we had done a lot of great things, some compelling actions. We had shifted the conversation in Florida and around the country around police violence. But we wanted to always be, from the beginning, a power-building organization. We wanted to build and change the dynamics of power in the state and in the country. And we looked at ourselves and we really assessed, had we built an organization that could do that? And in our analysis, we had in some ways, but we hadn't done and built the organization that we needed to sustain a powerful movement against right-wing interests in this state, against state-sanctioned violence. And so one of the areas that we felt we had a great strength in was social media and in culture. But in reflecting on our engagement with social media, what we found was it had become such a large self-curated echo chamber that it actually began to skew our analysis and skew our perception and skew our strategy. And so what we decided was, in order to be a deep, strong, community-based organization, those needed to be the voices, those needed to be the stories that we heard most often. And so in order to do that, we decided organizationally and some of us individually to take a hiatus from social media. And we made a statement about it because it was a larger indictment around activists or what people call slacktivists and people who have misplaced the tool of social media as the sole destination and the house for our movement. And that actually the hiatus actually deepened that analysis for us and that reflection for us and made it even more real. But we did that in order to muffle those loud voices and just the constant people bantering in a virtual reality and allow us to then turn up the volume on local voices, local issues, local stories, and start building local relationships. And so it's been very enlightening for us because what we find is, you know, what's big in other parts of the country or important in other parts of the country and what the movement for Black Lives currently is advocating is not always what people are talking about at their kitchen table in Miami or in Tampa or in Orlando and a lot of places across the South, a lot of places in Florida. And so if we want to be an organization that's reflective of what Florida needs and how Florida can be transformed, we needed to take that opportunity to listen.
Now, you currently have personalities like Deron McKesson who have gone into claim because of their social media activity. Hashtag Black Lives Matter propelled by Opal Tometi, Alicia Garza, and Patrice Cullors to fame as movement leaders for creating the hashtag on Twitter, then subsequently being able to create an organizational skeleton around that hashtag. How does the Dream Defenders fit into this constellation, considering that you all have been active in this type of activity since the beginning, going from Troy Davis to before Trayvon Martin here in Florida? Do you feel that social media caused perhaps those individuals mentioned, the Campaign Zero, hashtag Black Lives Matter coterie, to get attention and position they perhaps did not deserve based on what was actually going on the ground in Ferguson and Baltimore? In other words, I would like you to give me an insider's perspective on how the trajectory of fame and notoriety grew from individuals because of that social media reality. And do you really think it's reflective of what the realities are being done on the ground with the so-called movement for Black Lives?
Yeah, so what I will initially do is separate DeRay McKesson from the founders of Black Lives Matter. DeRay McKesson is a self-proclaimed activist from an Ivy League school and from Teach for America that created an online persona for himself and was able now to parlay that into huge revenue and also fledgling campaign for mayor in Baltimore. That's completely different than Alicia, Patrice, and Opal, who I met far before hashtag Black Lives Matter and have been organizing and have a history of doing deep grassroots organizing. And I think we should separate that, I guess if you want to call them camps, that camp from the DeRay McKesson camp. I think there was a time when Dream Defenders and myself were elevated to that same level. And I think social media has the power to accelerate and amplify even the smallest things. And that's not always the fault of those people. Do I think that the attention and the fame, possibly, and the applause that's been lauded on the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement and hashtag is unfounded? No, I don't. I think they did an amazing thing. I think, though, we conflate that amazing thing with being with the label movement leader. I don't think there's any one movement leader in any part of the country, because movements are made up of multiple people who can move multiple people. And it's this huge kind of chart of relationships that actually move something from one place to the other. I think what they created is something that we haven't seen since Occupy. And I think actually there are a lot of parts that are very important in noting, and I think they're the reasons that we have noted and bookmarked those three women is the fact that our movements typically have highlighted men. And I think there's an important part of elevating their names into the national and I also believe historical discourse that does a lot for actually advancing the culture of our movement forward. One that is not centered on just men, not centered on just individuals. It's three people, right? And so I think that is all well and good. Now, going from personal experience, being that person at one time that people were saying, oh, you're the next this. And, there were articles written about me calling me the next Madiba. There were organizational profiles written about Dream Defenders saying that, we were the next SNCC or we could be the next Panthers. I think people rush to do that way too quickly. And I think they're doing that with the founders of Black Lives Matter. I don't think they would be undeserving of a lot of the praise, but I think we rush so quickly at a new thing, at a different thing, and then anoint them with something that we recognize from the past so quickly. And I think that's unfair to the movement, and I think it's actually unfair to them. I don't think that was their intention when they began. I met them. I know them. That wasn't their intention when they began. They're some of the most humble people, but I do think they're fulfilling a role. And I've actually gone to cities after some of them have just left after a speaking thing, or I've gone to places when they were on their way, and people are really not just inspired, but they're getting educated by these three organizers who happen to also be people who started a hashtag that became something way bigger than they ever imagined. I say all that to say those three people are completely different than somebody who set out to create an online persona and a brand for themselves and make money from it.
Are you basically telling me, in your opinion, that D. Ray McKesson is a fraud?
No, I think he actually tells people quite clearly what he is. He's a one-man show, and he says that all the time. I'm not affiliated with an organization. He doesn't feel like he needs to be accountable to an organization. He's not an organizer. He's called himself a protester. I think that's basically what he is. We've actually given him a whole bunch of other monikers like movement leader that I don't know if he's called himself that, but he's a protester. He's a professional protester. That's what he's always called himself to be. He comes from a think tank that believes policy and neoliberal policy are the solutions to most of our problems. And that composes most of his platform points. That composes most of his campaign. And so I think actually he's been pretty clear about who he is. And I can't judge how black somebody is and not. But maybe in that way he's maybe exaggerated some things. But no, I think he's been clear what he is. He's a professional protester.
And then next with the mentors.
Recently, the three leaders of hashtag Black Lives Matter were profiled by Fortune magazine, one of the capitalist publications of record in this country.
Mm-hmm.
They were called some of the greatest leaders in America. Do you think that such recognition challenges the notion that Black Lives Matter is remotely a threat to the status quo, or perhaps merely a status quo organization?
I actually don't. Black Lives Matter was created to present a radical view. And everybody might not agree with it, but they believe, and many people that subscribe to the platform believe, that our country is inherently anti-black and business as usual couldn't continue. And I think there was a point where the movement was very, 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 very scary to the establishment. But there are a number of ways that the establishment fights back against something that's seen as a potential threat. One is what they used to do. They come and they come shoot up your office and they come beat you over the head. But now they do co-optation. And I think there's a huge co-optation campaign that's been waged. And I can't speak to folks' rationale or folks' reasoning for accepting a profile or accepting an award. We've accepted awards and we've accepted praise for things mm-hmm. that
I don't know, man. There's so many reasons why people do things like that that I wouldn't be damning on them for doing that. And I'm not just saying it to be politically correct. I would, you know, I don't know. You know, maybe it was important for Forbes readers to recognize that there was another force that is growing and that is capturing attention, that is shifting the conversation. And maybe that's the reason that they decided to feature it. Maybe, and this happened to me before. This is a true thing that happened to me before. I was in Time magazine in a profile and they never called me about it. I never even knew about it until somebody sent me a picture of they were reading Time magazine and I was in it. You know, that actually does happen. And that's what happens when you lose control of your image, when you lose control of, you know, your personal brand. It's not far-fetched for somebody next week, and you're going to be like, oh, you're coming at me. But it's not far-fetched next week for TheRoot.com to come out with the top 10 black radical authors and have you on there, and you just read about it. And you're like, oh, that's kind of the world we're in, and, you know. And shoot, it was Time magazine. So afterwards, I'm like, man, that really sucks, because I wish I could have told them my accurate bio, because they made up one. But then it's like, what do? Ask Time magazine to print a retraction and take me off the list. And, you know, it was just, I was already painted into a corner. So kind of to get back to your question, I think the founders of Black Lives Matter deserve a great deal of, what they have done is undeniable. I mean, we're talking about it right now. You know, they've created something that where a conversation was once marginalized and only happened amongst radicals to now being a dinner conversation around police brutality, state violence, around the place of women, the place of queer people in the movement. And I think that's very, very important. But co-optation is something that's really, really hard to avoid right now.
Now,
it really is.
I'm going to pivot
based
on what you're saying about them starting off as a radical organization and you believing that they are and still on status quo. At one point, they were endorsed by the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party does not endorse organizations or movements mm-hmm. that are a threat to the status quo. Mm-hmm. In light of that reality, how does that fit into your analysis of what this movement and its leaders represent to the power elite or the governing structure of this country?
I mean, I don't know, man. Like, they also came out and said, we don't want that endorsement. You know, it's like, the people who seek to co-opt you don't tell you they're doing it. They make overtures towards you. They do smoke and mirrors. They do things like, I mean, I've been to the White House. We talked about it. I wrote a piece about it. I still believe it's an invitation that's really hard to refuse. I do believe that. And I still do believe that it's an invitation that's hard to refuse, an invitation to have an audience with the President of the United States to be able to talk to him. And then afterwards, a picture happens, you know, and before you know it, this machine that's way bigger than you has found a way to kind of get that shot that they needed. And that happened to us in the Capitol. We were fighting for a meeting with the governor. And we wanted a meeting. And at that meeting, we wanted to be antagonistic. We wanted to be strong. And we were. But what happened is when we went into the room, it was all set up in a circle. And the photographer took the picture. And what you saw was a group of kids in a circle with a mediator, not like an evil governor. He was sitting and he looked like he was listening to us. And so I think just the power of co-optation, the power of this machine that we're in, especially in their control of media and their control of representation, is huge. And they can't help that a party endorses them. I think that the Democratic Party really, really loves Black Lives Matter? No, I think they wish they never existed and never started. But the Democratic Party is willing to say, hey, we do love them, at least say it, in order for people to doubt their efficiency and their effectiveness. Do I think they're the most radical arm of the radical movement? No. And neither are Dream Defenders right now. I don't know who that is right now. But I don't think they can help that, man. I really don't.
Now, I know that your organization is structured as a nonprofit. Is that correct?
We have a nonprofit status, yes.
Okay. And hashtag Black Lives Matter founders were all executives from the liberal nonprofit world, which is often financed by major corporations, wealthy institutions, and grants.
Mm-hmm.
This phenomenon is pejoratively known, as probably you know on the left, as the nonprofit industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't this turn all of these Black Lives Matter organizations basically into NGOs masquerading as black liberation movements? Will the revolution come after the wine and cheese during the next TED Talk?
That's a question that we've been asking ourselves for a long time. We started off, and for 2 years we had no funding, and it was actually pretty hard to survive. And after we took over the Capitol, we got a nonprofit status and were able to raise money and then be able to survive better. What I would say is, I think old school revolutionaries actually do have a point in that. You know, can organizations founded or organizations actually build a revolution using money from the very people that we're going to fight against? I don't have a yes or no answer. I know that there has to be some kind of way. You know, I had the opportunity to speak to somebody who shall remain unnamed, but was a part of a radical arm of the movement in the 60s and the 70s. And I asked them this exact same question. And this is exactly what they told me. They said, why are you worried about that? I asked them specifically, you know, how, you know, we have to get money from. And they said, why are you worried about that? We used to have to rob a Brinks truck. That's our money. Take it. Take the money. It's what you do with the money that really, I think, is the test. Is that the best answer for, I think, maybe old heads or people? But I don't think it's harder to understand how deeply entrenched the system is now in developing and nurturing organizations, and how hard it is for organizations without that to survive and to have any type of effect, any type of wide effect. It actually is quite hard to get to what we would call scale without having some kind of infusion of, whether it's money or whether it's free stuff. Like, you can use this office for free. You know, you can live in this house for free. We will feed you for free. If all of those things were possible and available to people in the movement, I think we wouldn't need so much money. You know, but people need a place to work. People need food to eat. And the Dream Defenders, I've been quoted saying this. You could quote me on this. The Dream Defenders have never taken a dollar from any organization, foundation. We've never taken money from the party. We've never taken money from any foundation. And they told us what we had to do with it or what we could do with it. Never. Not one time has it happened. We have been able to operate in the world based on the plans that we thought were best and through relationships with people. And they will fund that. Now, the issue is, because the nonprofit industrial complex is not just a relationship of money. It's also a relationship on surveillance. Because with the money, you have to what? You have to at least tell them you're doing something. And that's the part where it takes a lot of clever wording with things. Mm-hmm. And I think we've actually found a way to actually navigate the system quite well. We have never sold out. We've never moved or shifted any of our plans for any foundation. You could take that to the bank. No pun intended. Never have. Never. We've always built our plans based on what we thought was best and went out and sought out partners to help us fund that fit what we were doing. And that's it. And when we make proposals, this part is kind of OTR, but when we do proposals, we don't say everything that we're doing. And because surveillance is a big part of the relationship.
Have you been in a situation where you have taken money from major donors to the Democratic Party, i.e. unions, teachers unions, SEIU? I know this term comes up all the time, this allegation you're probably tired of hearing. Are you guys a Soros-financed movement, organization?
No, we don't have any money from Soros. What is Soros? Open Society?
Open Society, I think it's his organization.
No, we don't have any money from Open Society or George Soros. And the other question you have, we've actually addressed the SEIU question a lot. But I'll address that clearly because that's why people bring it up. When I first moved down to Miami with Gabriel Pendis, who was also one of our co-founders, no longer with the organization, and Nalini Stamp, who moved from Working Families Party down to Miami to help start the Dream Defenders, we all got jobs with SEIU. And we were able to survive working for SEIU and organizing Dream Defenders on our own time. That occurred for the first maybe 16 to 18 months of us being down here in Miami organizing Dream Defenders. So yeah, SEIU has supported us through that, basically through paying us to be field organizers with SEIU. After we left, our contract was over, they gave us about $50,000 to begin starting off the organization. They weren't the first people to fund us. We already had gotten other funding and actually had to create a whole proposal in order to continue in order to receive funds from them. So yeah, SEIU was there to help. But all of our stuff is public record too. I don't care when people say, oh, you got money from SEIU. SEIU is a union. And at one point,
unions were a huge part of the left. To some degree, they're a huge part of killing the left.
All right. Now, there's a lot of questions we can go to about that nonprofit because there's a class element as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not only about where you get your money, because there's a culture that comes along in the nonprofit industrial complex,
mm-hmm.
which is innately elitist,
yep.
anti-proletariat, not great grassroots, racist,
mm-hmm.
and creates a certain kind of organizational, technocratic mm-hmm. Echo chamber
yeah.
that some would argue, and I would as well, is not simpatico with grassroots organizing activity.
Mm-hmm.
Being that you have that structure and that is how you function, how do you fight against those tendencies that exist in this network? We know how the conferences and all. We know how the wine and cheese is all.
Yep.
We understand how the, you know, the three-piece jazz group is sitting down where we're talking about the latest white paper that was passed around.
Yeah.
We're familiar about how these dynamics are. Mm-hmm. There's a whole, quite frankly, I think let's be honest, most of the media left in America is financed by the nonprofit industrial complex.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, well, I mean, if we want to go historically, you know, the organization that most people think of outside of the Black Liberation Army as being the most radical is the Black Panther Party, and they got accused of being radical chic.
Mm-hmm.
They were up in New York with Jane Fonda and raising money, and
absolutely,
and Eldridge Cleaver was going around the country, and hobnobbing with some of the richest people. Huey Newton was getting his penthouse paid for by Hollywood. You know, I think there's always been. I'm not saying this is good or bad, and I'm not saying we're trying to follow in that lineage, but I think we should also make note that this isn't just a present day occurrence. That the left and radical elements of the left have always needed relationships in order to survive, and people with money have either because of fetish or strategy have always wanted to be close and find themselves in relationship with those people, personalities, and organizations. So I don't think that's anything new. I think currently it's really up to organizations like ours to continuously ask that question of us and continuously reflect: are we doing this? And that's what this whole 18, I kind of get passionate about. That's what this whole 18-month period has been about. The social media blackout was just one of the most public experiments that we put out before the world. But this whole 18-month period has been asking ourselves, how are we letting white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy still guide and build our organization and hide right beneath our noses? And how can we rid ourselves of that? And how can we make our theory into practice? And so, not only have we asked ourselves how social media affected us, but it's why is it that media only wants to talk to Umi, Ahmed, and Steve? Why is it that other leaders in the organization that contribute greatly to the organization, no matter how many times Umi preaches about them and talks about them, and no matter how many times Steven creates a package around them, why are they not the ones that people want to talk about? How can we switch that paradigm? How are we in our organization, our class analysis, well, most of our founders are college-educated folks, how are we being honest and earnest about wanting to build from the working class? And how can we challenge ourselves every single day in where we live, in where we play, in what we do, to actually be authentic with that? Because also, I do want to make note, yeah, we had mostly college-age students, but we also came from dirt poor backgrounds before college. So it's a whole lot of guilt. It's a whole lot of, you know, I mean, went home a month ago and just couldn't even believe I lived in the house I grew up in. I was like, oh my God, I got to remember this again. So, you know, there's a lot of questions that we've been asking, and I know it sounds tangential, but the nonprofit industrial complex, funding, money, and how capitalism, frankly, is able to insidiously mold and become like the glue of many organizations, and how they're structured is something we're serious about creating new. And in the next few months, what we are going to actually pivot to is an organization that actually more resembles the principles that we put forth. And the principles that we're putting forth is that it's not non-hierarchical just to be saying that. We're trying to build a society that is build an organization that is non-exploitive, that is rooted in an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, international humanist frame. And, you know, we're also prepared for if funders don't vibe with that, as when we went to Palestine, we did lose funders. and we're going to Palestine. We've gone again, and we're going again this year. The money isn't going to change what we do. We're going to see how far we can get with the money, and if we lose it, we do something else.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.